Okay, I'm going to give a brief talk about introduction to modeling. The reason for talking about this is because many people come from different backgrounds. Obviously, this is an interdisciplinary type of endeavor, and it's, I think, useful to just give a broad overview of modeling specifically for the purposes of, well, that are relevant to threat anticipation. So for those of you that know all this, well, that's fine, you know, just revel in the knowledge. And for those of you who don't, then, you know, let's get some interesting discussion started, or at least have a prelude into some of our other talks on modeling. So briefly, I'm going to talk about modeling methods and modeling approaches. Secondly, I'm going to give some examples of models, and in particular, these are going to be agent-based models. And then lastly, talk about some issues in decision-making. So the context for modeling and its intended use. The question is, why do we do modeling and simulation at all? I guess this is for the non-believers in particular. No, well, those are not necessarily the same, David. Anyway, reasons we do modeling and simulation. Because we are constrained by linear thinking. There is research out there on decision making, processing of information, that concludes that people are very poor at understanding such things as second order effects and also cascading events with their traditional mental model. So it is kind of a cognitive processing constraint. Secondly, we cannot imagine all the possibilities that the real system may exhibit. Thirdly, we cannot foresee the full effects, as I just stated, of cascading events with our limited mental models. And fourthly, we cannot foresee novel events that our mental models cannot imagine. And of course, when I'm talking about modeling and simulation, I'm talking about using computers to augment the process of mental modeling. We model for insights, not for numbers, it's been said. We model for explanations. As an exercise, perhaps in thought space, to exercise ourselves mentally, to gain insights into key variables. And secondly, to construct reasonable arguments, qualitative as they may be, as to why events can or cannot occur based on the calculations in our model. Oftentimes, we would like to model to make qualitative or even quantitative predictions about the future. Although it's been mentioned earlier, we had this discussion, we're not really saying as modelers our goal is to predict the future. Nonetheless, it is, for the most part, the position of many people we interact with, decision makers, etc., that indeed we are, in some sense, trying to predict the future. Yes?
We make a point when we brief out that yeah. That's exactly what we're not doing.
Right. Yeah.
So I end up first two major bullets, totally agree, but that last bullet, that's where we usually get ourselves in trouble. They think we're making a prediction.
Okay. Well, you know, thank you. I'll put the word not in there next time around. But the issue is, how is that received by decision makers?
When you let them know that it's for insights, for structured decisions, et cetera, and you know, the second, third order effects, that's where you know, we make our money with the decision makers. And they understand that, you know, at least in my realm,
yes.
That it's not a prediction.
Okay, well, that's good feedback, actually, to hear from the trenches how the case is going over, because it certainly wasn't that way in the earlier days of modeling and simulation. Yeah, so you actually staged the slide so you could make that comment, or hopefully could. Anyway, thank you. So we have here's just what I would call it an array of modeling approaches available for social and cultural research. This is not an exhaustive list, but it is useful for framing the whole thought process, starting with what I would call very descriptive models, such as what I would call accounting and data models. And I'll get two slides on each one of these with just a little more information. Moving on up to statistical modeling or inductive inferencing through social network analysis. We talked about Nancy talked about networks earlier. Two more dynamic types of processes embedded in social networks, to things like so-called systems dynamics models, and finally agent-based modeling and its reliance on complexity theory, which I'm not going to go into, but it's certainly those two are very much connected, agent-based modeling, complexity. As we go down this list, the models become less simply descriptive, but more representative of the processes that occur within the system being modeled and for which we're trying to model. Okay, accounting and data models. Well, these are kind of, I've worked on a few government programs that are trying to do this kind of thing, and they do have value, quite a bit of value. First of all, we begin with some descriptive data. The data may be data collected from the field, whether it's a theater of operations or something like that. We add opinions, conjectures, inferences, maybe even some estimates. The data may be qualitative, may be kind of symbolic, or we just may not know all the data entries. But immediately we go from the data to what amounts to a more organized, structured, appealing visualization of the data, such as one might want to see in terms of some situational awareness kind of display. And there are a lot of, as I said, programmatic modeling efforts to do that. It should be worth stating that these technically are not models. They are often referred to as models. They're often promoted as models. But nonetheless, there is no process embedded within here other than just a nice way and a very important and useful way to display basic data, such as perhaps in a geographical information system. So at the next level of, I would call sophistication, are things like inductive inferencing. So basically, we have models that are driven exclusively by the data. For example, text processing systems, such as, in which text goes in, there are some derived associations amongst the text items, such as word proximity, you know, Al-Qaeda, being positioned closely in words to terrorism, to weapons of mass destruction, etc., and those things can be derived from the text. Patterns are extracted. These could either be visual, as I call it, or more objective, a more objective structured relationship. Secondly, we could add probabilistic inferencing of uncertain relationships, let's say, again, between the text. 35% of the time, Al-Qaeda occurs with the term weapon of mass destruction, and the rest it doesn't, those kind of things. Bayesian analysis, which was mentioned earlier, is just a way to work a lot with the data and derive these probabilistic estimates, and such that the more data you have, the better your estimates become, higher probability. And then related to this area is, you know, so-called data mining that many people are doing, where data goes in, structural relationships that characterize correlations among data items come out of this. And these can be very useful at identifying patterns or relationships. I would put the famous cultural simulation model by Indici in this category. Essentially, and here we have just as an example, various concepts and mappings that are coming out of the system based on the structured relationships that are actually input to begin with, as a function of some textual input that was processed. These systems are very useful and widely used for kind of free-form data analysis. Now, kind of moving on up, it's worth mentioning, we talked about networks today, and why are networks such a big deal? Well, this is a quote from a recent report by the National Research Council, Board on Army Science, networks lie at the core of the economic, political, and social fabric of the 21st century. Another quote, investment in network science is both a strategic and urgent national priority as a way of analysis, as an analysis tool and vehicle. So just moving on to networks, what does that have to do with anything? Well, there is a field called social network analysis, SNA. I'm calling it social network modeling here, in which the fundamental structure, data structure you operate with is a network. Think of network nodes as being people. They could be groups. Links in the network are relationships among people or groups. It's the basic idea. Questions one would ask about networks in a very static way are who is connected to who. This is, you know, widely used in intelligence analysis of looking at contacts, information, who has bank accounts where, who knows who, who's met with, who's been to this place. Even semantically, we could represent those kind of relationships as networks. And then see how closely various things are related, doing mathematical, algorithmic path analysis, or even cluster analysis. In terms of terrorist networks, we would, you know, could ask questions like, well, who is key in this network such that if we eliminate them, there's vastly reduced connectivity and those kind of issues. And there are more sophisticated algorithms that can be applied in which we might even infer larger network structures that are not visible or based on actual observations from a very small amount of data in a probabilistic sense. So there is work on hidden networks that are, you know, embedded in larger potential network structures. So in terms of, you know, moving on from the more descriptive kind of approaches to actual modeling, there's really, it's worth noting that there are different modeling philosophies for social science modeling in particular. There's two kinds of models based on these modeling philosophies. Some models are small, I would characterize as small, elegant models that capture the essential elements and features of the real-world system that are important or being studied. At least that's the assertion of the model developer. And I'll talk a little bit about some examples of those kind of models. At the other extreme, there are large, complex, detailed models that capture as many of the characteristics of the real world as possible. So this is a continuum. This issue is a continuing issue in modeling and how people regard, accept, relate to models, and even how they use them. And it's been described by Kathleen Carley as the essential tension between model transparency and veridicality, which means the truth of the model at representing the system. But transparency at the other extreme is the key virtue of small, elegant models. So these issues come up with every modeling project, and one can, you know, reject models by taking the opposite position that the model has taken. So moving on very briefly to the world of simulation, I've got here what I would call systems dynamics. And systems dynamics has been used since the 1950s as a modeling technique. There's a whole series of how to do systems dynamics modeling. It has a long tradition. It began, for the most part, as a social modeling technique. But it came from, for those of you that are familiar with physical systems, how to do physical modeling, systems dynamics models are based on physical system modeling using things like differential equations. And essentially what the procedure is to build such a model is to specify the system as consisting of a set, generally a small set, of what the main state variables are that describe the system. And using what's called a visual causal diagram to link the various variables together and the other factors that influence how the state variables essentially go up and down. So here we have a very simple model that we were using on a project to look at how suicide terrorism, you know, comes about, and what factors, at least in terms of their identification in a qualitative way, would be important at and the direction of causality that is being up or down by some of the various variables. Systems dynamics models tend to be very aggregate, just a handful of state variables. And it's the modeling traditions, because computers at the time this technique was developed really did not have a lot of capacity. Now, there's another kind of model that's probably worth mentioning here, because it really links, this approach really links traditional economics and political science and other fields that do modeling, at least qualitatively, through the use of what's called the rational choice model, or as I call it, the rational actor model. Not agent, but actor. There's a distinction there. And the central assumption is that actors behave rationally according to what is in their best interests. And in the field of economics, that really amounts to some developing a model in which either producers, consumers, et cetera, maximize some form of utility. If you're a business and modeling a business, you're maximizing profit, which is much easier to specify. But there are even ways to measure utility based on multi-attributed utility theory and things like that, subject to some physical constraints, maybe on your budget or on your degree of resources, things like that. Now, if we put these kind of rational choice models together, so we have a bunch of actors, and they all have their own rational choice models, maybe they're not the same necessarily, then we get multiple interacting actors. And then game theory, traditional game theory, becomes applicable, and the concepts of Nash, equilibrium, et cetera. And that's where we get to the final bullet here. Solving such models really amounts to finding an equilibrium solution where, like in the case of Nash equilibrium, each actor cannot do better than they are doing given the actions or decisions of all the other actors. So there's an equilibrium notion there across all actors. Such equilibrium could possibly be observed in the real world in the long run. But many people have objections academically to the notion of the rational choice model, in the sense that there is a new field called essentially behavioral economics, in which somebody said, hey, wait a minute, why don't we actually go out and see how people decide things and talk to them? And so, you know, it's kind of led to a proliferation that people don't actually behave rationally or optimally. So they're still sorting that out. However, it's worth noting that rational choice models are useful. It depends on the context and whether that's appropriate for them or not. But for example, some of the economic modeling we saw yesterday is founded on the notion of being, you know, the rational choice model, like the households are maximizing some kind of consumer decisions and their own well-being. So now, let's just briefly mention, you know, culture and things like that. Well, you know, culture is kind of dynamic, and you know, it's multi-scale, and it has a lot of messiness to it. Sometimes extremal movements are very important in drawing the, you know, civilizational themes that result in, you know, eventual radical changes in the whole system structure, things like that. So anyway, but multi-layer interactions can be represented by agent-based models. And I would say that it's probably both virtually impossible to represent that in any other kind of modeling technique, and that's why we come to agent modeling that you've heard about as one of the primary techniques for representing social systems, culture, things like that. Okay. Agent-based modeling is built on the notion that we're going to build a system from the ground up. So we're going to model the individual elements. Basically, those are the agents, and just kind of build on top of that till we get to a system. Systems dynamics models and others have this top-down notion. Let's just start with the state variables and just maybe add a little detail, but then we'll stop. Agent-based modeling always kind of brings out the question, what is an agent? Well, an agent basically is an individual with a set of characteristics or attributes, a set of rules governing agent behaviors, or, you know, in this context, decision-making capability. I mean, you can model bacteria, but you can't say that they have decision-making capability particularly. And then some notion of protocols for communication. These protocols allow agents to respond to the environment and also to interact with other agents in the system. One aspect of this, and the fact why this is kind of a new thing, is because the driving force behind agent-based simulation is the maturation of computers and the provision of unprecedented levels of computational power that allow us to begin to think of modeling individual agents as individuals, as opposed to some immediate necessity of aggregation or summary description of agents. And agents can be diverse, and they can be, well, and heterogeneous. And then these aspects are some of the drivers that lead to emergence and the things Nancy was talking about earlier, which we won't go into in much detail right now. So just because I knew you would be so enthused about learning more about agents, I decided to add another slide that shows more how we would begin to think about modeling, one step into that direction. Here's a typical agent representation, and this is very close to how we would model it in the computer, but it's missing, you know, a lot of details, of course. So first of all, here we have an agent there at the top, and there's really two things involved, that's all. The agent attributes and the agent mechanisms. So you can think of those as a list or a list of things or some kind of data structure. And here's a bunch of agent attributes that I've listed of the kind of attributes that we find in agent-based models of social systems or, you know, related things to, in particular, national security. We might be interested in every agent having an ethnicity, a tribe, a clan, religion, age, sex, resources, an actual location, for example. And through the location, the agent can be inferred environmental aspects. So if an agent is at a certain location, it might, you know, have access to water or access to fertile ground or things like that. And then the agent has some private things like goals, objectives, strategies, likes or dislikes. We're not necessarily saying the agent's maximizing or anything, but they certainly like one thing more than another. Or maybe they have a goal, and that goal can be used to discern their actions as being better or worse. And then, importantly, we have social context, such as who are the agent's neighbors, who are their kin, perhaps, what groups they're members of. And these social contexts form the basis for the links between the agents. And then we also have strategic information that an agent could, not necessarily, but could, depending on the application, remember. The history of other agent interactions, you know, if those were positive or negative or whatever. The anticipation of others' actions and expectations. On the other side, we have agent mechanisms. And one way to think of it is that these are basically decision-making processes or rules of behavior, things such as how an agent moves or why it moves from one place to another, and also the rules of interaction with other agents. So if we're modeling things like contagion of disease, we would have rules of interaction. Like it could be as simple as the probability that two agents come together at the same location and they exchange some infectious agent. Resource exchange. Two agents come together, the strong agent takes all the resources from the weak agent, for example. These mechanisms are, depends on what the nature of the model is and why it's structured. Now, agents can be adaptive in the sense that these rules can actually change. So think of adaptation and agents as consisting of rules that change the rules of the agent. And there's various ways to represent rules in terms of the level of abstraction. You may have heard of genetic algorithms or genetic programming. It's a very abstract way to represent rules. Or there could be very concrete ways, such as if-then rules. Okay, so agents can be adaptive. And, you know, groups or social structures or even terrorist networks can form and be generated by the model itself. So there's this whole notion that social structure can and should arise within the model or endogenously in the model. And that's actually a field called generative social science, which David will talk more about later. I'm sure he's working on that slide right now, since I mentioned it. Well, anyway, you know, some models that are out there in existence in the world that I could point to infer some kind of notion of agent identity from some list of attributes that the agent possesses. And some models that are out there in the literature even infer some notion of culture in the sense that these are shared rules that are shared amongst agents that are passed down through time potentially. So these are at least one kind of weak way to talk about identity or culture. But in any case, that's where these things at least fit in. Now here's a very simple example, and this is probably the first social agent simulation. It's called the Schelling model. We heard Thomas Schelling mentioned earlier today by Charlie Glaser. But essentially, the Schelling model wanted to look at the reasons for segregation in terms of housing segregation. And he said, okay, we're going to have two kinds of agents, red agents and blue agents, and we're going to randomly situate them on this little grid or map. But we're going to give the agents a couple of rules, actually three rules. In the Schelling model, agents would like to have about, 25% of their neighbors to be their same color, but only 25%. And they don't care about the other 75% of their neighbors particularly. And if an agent has that number of neighbors that are the same color, it's satisfied. It doesn't move. It's very happy. Otherwise, the agent looks for the nearest unoccupied site that satisfies this preference, and then he moves there. And so on the right here, this is one of Schelling's results, and it showed that, in effect, broad patterns of segregation can develop based on no more than the agent's desire to have a couple of neighbors like themselves, as opposed to rules that suggest they were trying to get away from agents that they did not want to, live next to. But one of the implications of this work, which really started the whole field, was that the overall systematic patterns that are observed, and these are what we would call emergent patterns, are in no way inferable from the individual rules of the agent. The agents are not trying to establish this pattern, yet it arises anyway on the basis of these rules. So this was a very counterintuitive kind of finding and has implications directly with complexity theory and stuff like that. But anyway, just very briefly, Axtell and Joshua Epstein, you know, kind of took this idea, almost 10 years ago now, and just kind of decided to model whole artificial societies and abstractly represent a whole set of social processes and then see what they got out of this. They wrote this book and demonstrated a whole wealth of information that could be, again, produced by this type of agent-based modeling approach. that had direct correlations or comparisons to real-world processes. And they did this work to kind of open up the field of agent-based modeling. And so I just wanted to briefly mention a more, okay, those were like elegant models that I talked about. Here's a case where this is some work that people have been doing in the Southwest that was recently published, actually last July, in Scientific American, in which some anthropologists, I have the reference down here, wanted to look at the kind of the establishment of households and movement and settlement patterns in the Southwest United States in a place called Longhouse Valley. So anyway, essentially, they set up the model and inferred a relatively small set of rules for the agents in terms of their preferences and situations, but then they also heavily modeled like the physical environment relative to rainfall, moisture, soil characteristics, and worked in various agricultural aspects of growing seasons, things like that. And in effect, they concluded that they were able to reproduce population clustering in the same kind of pattern in areas that have been observed in the archaeological record. And down here, just to add some quantitative quasi-validation, they were able to kind of reproduce with the model some of the observed patterns in nature. So the extension to kind of like real societies then was was made, and other people are doing this kind of work as well. Some interesting aspects of and these are some descriptions from their paper: cultural algorithms, framework for simulating social and cultural changes. Basically, aside from the basic simulations that they did, they also created within their agents, for additional runs, planning. They included planning mechanisms for procuring resources. Plans that let's see here. And in the model, the plans that tended to be proved to be most productive were selectively saved within the population, and in effect transmitted across the various agents and forward through time, and actually codified then within the model in rules that other agents could use. Additional work looked at the incorporation of networks, kinship networks, in which these relationships among kin were much more likely to result in exchange mechanisms, establishment of trust, and things like that. And using those additional algorithms, they were able to come up with some additional interesting results in terms of modeling some aspects of the record which were not apparent from kind of the baseline simulations. So we're getting to a case here where people at least are modeling culture or mechanisms of culture in an incorporation of these into the models. Now, I always like to give a plug for all the ASCO models, of course. And this is an agent-based threat anticipation model that Ed McCarroll from Los Alamos is working on. And he essentially is taking this approach to model various areas of the world, such as the Middle East, and the potential for terrorist generation and recruitment using the very detailed socioeconomic data that's available for those regions, the different positions that various groups have for each other, et cetera. So it's another example of the basic framework being applied to this area. And Ed's model has been mentioned several times here, I believe. So anyway, towards I'll finish very quickly here. Towards model use, Verification and validation are essential parts of the process of model development. Verification is really verifying the model works right, you know, the code works. Validation, though, is a much harder problem, and that consists of the model meeting its intended requirements and the methods as well as the results obtained being valid in some way. I won't go into this too much, but essentially the objective of the kind of things we're trying to do ultimately in the end with JTAC is to not lose sight of the fact that there is a decision maker at the end of the process. There may be a user policy analyst who actually has their hands on the model, and the intervening domain experts and developers along with the computer model itself, as well as the real world system, all are part of this package of creating models that have the highest possibility of being used. And to recognize that this process exists during the model development process is really essential to ensuring that ultimately the right path is followed to a usable model. So there are various kinds of aspects of validation which have to do with social science theory and the social science that is used within the model. There's just several questions here that we're addressing on an ongoing basis. And the whole notion of validation frameworks in terms of just asking the basic question of what constitutes a validated model in the social sciences versus the physical sciences, for which we can, in the physical sciences, sometimes we can do controlled, explicit, repeatable experiments upon and make sure we get the model right. In the social sciences, of course, we don't have that luxury, ever, for the most part. Although there are some interesting experiments in behavioral economics and things that we can bring into the process to, like, elucidate agent behaviors and things like that. In terms of validation resources, there's a whole list of both traditional modeling and simulation literature, social science theory validation itself, which is independent of model validation, and up to and including human behavior representation and a validation of how that comes about as well. So, it's a very broad issue, and we're seeking to try to stitch together these various fields and aspects to understand how we can do something that is useful to people. Pathways to validation, we can explore cases, we can use models as exploratory laboratories, do a lot of what-ifing. We can use multiple models for the same problem that have slightly different perspectives. We can have the broadest possible diverse set of model ensembles in the cases in which we use them, and then, the use of subject matter experts and computational simulation as a special case of analytical modeling, a more general case, are all aspects that, we need to apply to really get to the point at which we say, yes, the model is credible because it's passed all these experiments, or it's invalid because of failures in many, many counts. The basic conclusions are we need to go from theory to computation. We need an overarching conceptual framework. There's a need for a process to go from theory to conceptual models to computer models. We're going to look at a little bit about that coming up next. And from basic research to Manhattan Project results. Well, the conclusion that progress is needed in the social and complexity sciences. No breakthroughs such as relativity, quantum mechanics, et cetera, have occurred yet. And we're probably not that close yet either. So I've got some references at the end if anybody's interested. Okay, so I just gave that talk to introduce the subject. We could probably hold off discussion till later. I want to move on to the next talk and